This is a podcast by The Straits Times.
Welcome back to Green Pulse. We're starting off 2024 with an appropriately green theme, renewable energy. Specifically, the investment opportunity for green power in Southeast Asia. The region is one of the world's economic growth engines, and it's hungry for power to drive that growth, fuel its factories, and lift millions out of poverty. And yet, it remains deeply dependent on polluting coal, oil, and gas. But cleaner wind and solar, and increasingly battery storage, are becoming more competitive and compelling investment choices. So what is the outlook? Are we on the cusp of a green revolution? Our guest today is Mr. Edward Northam, Head of Core Renewables and Head of Asia Pacific for Macquarie Asset Management Green Investments. Singapore-based Mr. Northam is a veteran of the clean energy space, and today we ask him for an investor's point of view of the opportunities in the region. Welcome to the show, Ed.
Thanks, David. Thanks for having me.
So let's start off with the opportunities for renewable energy in Southeast Asia. Each year, demand for electricity is growing at 4-5% in the region, which is quite a lot. Plus, interest rates are likely to start falling this year. So that would suggest a brighter outlook for renewable energy, wouldn't it?
Yeah, well, listen, I'm probably not brave enough to predict interest rate movements in the near term. But what I do have real conviction around is the opportunity for renewables across the Asian region. We know already that the Asia-Pacific region represents about 52% of global power demand. And all of the forecasts that we look at tell us that that percentage should increase to about 68% by 2040. China speaks for a material portion of that growth in power demand, but almost a third of that we expect to come through Southern and Southeast Asia. So that represents for us an enormous opportunity to increase capacity installations across all of the renewables, fuels and technologies. We think an increase at about tenfold from where we sit today across that part of the world.
And what sort of value are we talking about from what it is now to what it could be?
So if we measure that in terms of numbers, that represents an investment opportunity, which is how we think about it, of at least $300 to $400 billion through that period.
That's out to 2030, or is that?
That's out to 2030, yeah. So that's out to 2030.
That's a lot of money, yeah. And where do you see the best opportunities for renewable energy investment? So in terms of the countries that look the most attractive and the types of renewable energy, for example, solar, onshore or offshore wind and energy storage?
So there's a combination of factors that contribute to sort of how I would respond to that. Firstly, what we've seen is a sort of, you know, decade-long now reduction in the cost of renewable energy across the established technologies, combined with that sort of growing demand and increasing sort of penetration we expect to see from renewables. And what that's really sort of driven is, I think, an increased focus from sort of governments and policymakers around the region to really sort of double down on the opportunity to capture lower cost and greater energy security by transitioning their, you know, and pivoting their focus to support the rollout of renewables. Our colleagues in Macquarie Capital, so another part of the Macquarie Group, would estimate on a cost-saving basis, we've seen about $4 billion US in cost savings through the last couple of years as part of the energy crisis in terms of moving and increasing the focus on renewables. So that's what really underpins the opportunity we see. And if we translate that through into sort of tangible action across the region, we've seen Malaysia introduced its latest national energy transition sort of roadmap. We've seen Singapore making a meaningful transition or progress on their commitment to 4 gigawatts of clean energy import. We've seen the Philippines open up the renewable energy sector for foreign investment. We've also seen renewable energy pricing reform in Vietnam and more recently in Indonesia. These are regions that are then really attractive from an investment perspective and from a deployment of established technologies across actually all of the renewables, but be that sort of onshore wind and solar, but also the development of offshore wind technology, which has got a huge role to play, given the scale and capacity that that technology can operate at.
Now, you've given us a sense of the size of the investment opportunity, but what sort of returns, speaking as an investor, what sort of returns on investment percentage are we talking about? I guess it varies, obviously, from the type of technology and the location, but what sort of percentage return makes it attractive for you?
Yeah, so from a returns perspective, it does vary by technology and it varies by sort of market. It also varies by stage of the project. So, you know, it depends on when parties get involved in supporting a project from a financial perspective, the sort of the return they look for to take on that investment is in part driven by the risk profile and therefore the stage of project life cycle. If you're developing a project that brings certain risk with it that you'll want to be compensated for from a financial return perspective versus investing into established sort of projects. What underpins the return across the renewable energy sort of landscape, including and increasingly in this part of the world, is actually that growing sort of demand for renewables, and what that demand, which is growing and actually growing at a faster rate than supply, ensures is that the economics from an investment perspective are constructed in a way that ensures that capacity gets delivered. Yeah. So it's not really possible to talk to you around a single figure because of that different sort of spectrum of stage of investment. The more relevant consideration is that the resilience and the attractiveness of renewables from a financial investment perspective to support the broader agenda of making this transition to a cleaner sort of energy supply and to a decarbonised environment.
Now, in terms of growing those investments, is it possible that all of that rapid growth in power demand can be met by new renewable energy investments, or it's going to take a bit of time to get up to that level, particularly since the region still relies heavily on fossil fuels for roughly about 3/4 of its energy needs?
So according to the International Energy Agency, even with the impact of intermittent generation, solar energy combined with growing sort of wind capacity is both the cheapest source of bulk power supply and capable of meeting at least 70, maybe 80% of the generation mix in most regions across the world. So what this means is renewable energy sort of combined with technologies that support and enhance the intermittency of that generation sort of profile can actually supply almost all of the power needs that that growing economies can meet. That said, what we do know is that fossil fuel generation will continue to play a role in the generation mix in the near to medium term. That recognition, I think, really underpins the need to develop other technologies such as carbon capture and storage that can more efficiently deal with the environmental impacts, and in particular the carbon emissions associated from continuing to burn fossil fuels.
Hmm. Now, of course, despite the promise, there are still significant roadblocks to investment for renewable energy in the region and a faster uptake of renewables. So what would be your top three areas that need to be addressed to really unlock a faster investment and faster sort of adoption?
Well, let me start by saying we know from our own business, from our clients, that there is no shortage of capital that has an appetite to invest in the acceleration, the rollout of renewable energy. We've seen in the last 6 months a record level of investment into renewable energy, $360 billion in the last 6 months, which certainly the market commentators suggest is a record for any six-month period. So this is not a capital challenge. What we do know, however, is there is friction in the delivery models, right? Be that the need to upgrade and invest in our transmission and distribution networks to make them really more responsive, more fit for purpose for this change in generation mix. Planning and permitting programs to really accelerate the process of new installations. Building out and supporting supply chain across sort of multi markets. All of these are elements that contribute to the rate and pace at which we can deploy new renewable energy capacity. And all of these are areas that to a greater or less extent need further focus, further investment and further support. Now, of course, this isn't new news, however, to the industry. It's not new news to governments. And we're seeing in multiple markets the government respond to those sorts of challenges. Calling out an example, the Biden administration, the US, and its commitment to investment in really sort of transforming America's sort of electricity grid as an example of how governments are responding.
But there is there's also the issue of fossil fuel subsidies and, of course, the power of fossil fuel incumbency, you know, of the oil and gas and coal sector in the region. That is also a bit of a roadblock that needs to be tackled, I think, to really drive greater investment. So what's your view on that as an investor?
Yeah. So, David, this is a complex issue. And sitting at the core of the energy transition is how we make this a just and equitable transition. With any transition, there are benefits, but it also comes with a cost. And that needs to be carefully considered and managed. So making an overnight sort of transition as a blunt instrument is probably not the most effective way to go about this. That's where what we see is the value of setting up sort of long-term policy, maybe tariff regimes that support a progressive transition to a more or less carbon intensive generation sort of mix. Also thinking about the way regulations and markets operate in a way that can facilitate things such as the introduction of bilateral power purchase agreements. So what we've seen in the last number of years is a deeper commitment from corporates and industrial companies around their own net zero agenda. And increasingly around the world, the way that's translating is that they are choosing their own source of power supply to support their industrial activities and businesses and are directly procuring renewable energy, you know, on a basis that supports that agenda, but also on a basis that works for them from a financial and a business operation perspective. By facilitating a market or a regulatory regime that enables that to happen, you can make a more progressive sort of transition in a way that enables sort of the community, our economy, to make its own decisions about the rate at which, you know, the speed at which it transitions away from fossil fuels towards renewables.
Now, you've been in the clean energy space for quite a long time, I think more than 20 years. So can you tell us a little bit more about yourself and, of course, about Macquarie Green Investment Group, which has quite a large pipeline of projects in development in the region?
So you're right, and thank you for aging me. I've been working for, it's actually getting on to 30 years across the renewable energy space, and I've done a range of things through that journey, including establishing what was at the time Australia's first dedicated clean energy investment fund. And then more recently, I had the privilege of supporting the UK government in establishing what was at the time the world's first dedicated green investment bank. And that was an activity that I took on through the creation of that institution and ultimately through its privatisation, which is where Macquarie stepped in terms of acquiring that business. And that's what brought me across onto the Macquarie platform. Macquarie has actually been investing in renewables for a couple of decades now. And today, across all of our green investment activity, we're pursuing about 95 gigawatts of new project development. So that's making new sort of projects happen to really drive this transition. We're managing about 15 gigawatts of operating assets, and we've got multiple gigawatts in construction as well. So by any measure, certainly we would say a leading sort of operator in the renewable energy space. And our own business has actually been going through somewhat of a transition where we started initially looking at project-by-project solutions and then recognising that if we wanted to drive the sort of volume that we've been talking about in this discussion, we really moved our focus beyond project by project to actually creating and supporting businesses. At the moment, businesses operating across 25 or so global sort of markets, but supporting them at a level that enables us to scale and that creates that really attractive investment opportunity for our client base.
Now, despite renewable energy being around for quite a long time, particularly wind and solar, there are still some myths that surround it, such as it's costly, it's intermittent, and there are questions around reliability. We occasionally see all sorts of comments on social media sort of criticising renewable energy. And yet there are really good examples that show that next generation power grids supported by wind and solar and energy storage can work, is effective, and just as good as the old-fashioned grid. So I think, you know, there are examples in Australia, but perhaps give us one or two examples from Australia as to where this is really taking off.
Yeah. So, David, it's absolutely right that we're not going to deliver true energy transition here by just focusing on established renewable energy sort of technologies. And that's why we as a business are also supporting the development, the commercialization of the emerging technologies that will really drive deeper decarbonisation. And by that I mean decarbonisation at an industrial level and across our transport sector. And one of the technologies that would be critical in that that you've identified there is storage. It has a critical role to play in enabling the deployment of more renewable energy, right, by being able to store electricity, you know, at the time it's produced through, you know, intermittent and renewable resources, and then deliver that energy at a time of greater energy demand, or sort of effectively sort of load shifting, as we describe it, you know, will be really fundamental in terms of increasing, you know, the rate at which we can decarbonise and frankly electrify. Yeah. It's actually for that reason we've launched a dedicated energy storage business called Eku sort of Energy. And you asked for some Australian examples, and a great one that I sort of talked to in that is the Hazelwood Battery Energy Storage System that Eku has developed. It's a great story because it takes an old power station site, coal-fired power station site, and reuses sort of the infrastructure and its access to the local transmission and distribution sort of network to create what certainly was at the time Australia's largest energy storage system. And certainly will, you know, that project alone will play an enormous role in decarbonising Victoria's electricity grid.
Yep. Now, at the recent COP28 climate talks, nearly 200 nations supported a call to triple global energy, global renewable energy capacity by 2030. So what impact do you think this will have on Southeast Asian governments and investors?
What might actually surprise people is that a tripling of renewable energy capacity globally is actually business as usual. So we're already on that rate. And with sort of regions like China, like the EU, like the US, certainly, you know, alongside the Inflation Reduction Act in the US, we're going to deploy sufficient renewable energy capacity to meet that sort of that commitment. We're on track to do that. So what I find really exciting about that commitment is how the other signatories to that commitment are going to respond, how they're going to develop actionable plans to play a role in markets and parts of the world where they may not have actually made as much progress as some of the sort of more pioneering regions. So if we look at Southeast Asia, how countries that are still heavily fossil fuel dependent, well, we'll translate that commitment into an actionable plan. The other thing to note is that that commitment, a tripling of renewable energy capacity, it hasn't actually been broken down by technology, by subsector. So a tripling of solar capacity and installation of solar energy is actually fairly straightforward. But what would be really transformational is if we could triple wind energy capacity. That would be both transformative for the sector, but also will have an even greater impact on decarbonisation just because of the scale at which sort of wind can operate. Yeah. And then the last thing I'd call out around that sort of COP commitment, and I think it's something that hasn't been as broadly reported as the sort of headline figures, is the commitment from the signatories, or the recognition from the signatories to that commitment, about the need to accelerate permitting processes and timelines to boost grid capacity and grid connections, the need and the requirement to provide greater clarity and long-term focus on the incentive and policy regimes that are going to be, you know, really fundamental to removing roadblocks and facilitating sort of an acceleration of this transition.
Now, of course, Singapore, although it's a small country, it wants to import a significant amount of low-carbon energy, and it's a major finance hub. So how do you see Singapore helping Southeast Asia accelerate its transition to green energy? And what is Macquarie seeing in terms of policies and financial support in Singapore for investors and the region that will really, you know, keep things, you know, the investment sort of growing?
It's been great to see Singapore really thinking about how it can use its status as a financial hub to really accelerate and drive broader investment in the energy transition across not just Singapore, but regionally. As an example of that, we're seeing the Singapore Central Bank Monetary Authority of Singapore, you know, increase its focus on the rollout of blended finance programs. So this is where public money is used to help crowd in private sector investment, either by taking a first loss piece, by providing guarantees, or oftentimes just providing local market knowledge, expertise and confidence as a way of supporting the investment thesis or the investment opportunity for the sector. And we've seen firsthand the benefit of these sorts of programs. At the moment in India, Macquarie is working with the UN's Green Climate Fund to drive the adoption of electric commercial vehicles and buses. Yeah. In this situation, the Green Climate Fund have committed $200 million of initial capital to really help us establish that business. Alongside that, we will crowd in private sector capital to match and actually over the longer term exceed that investment quantum. Our current expectation is just through that business alone, we can create about a $1.5 billion investment opportunity while also providing a demonstration effect for how you support the transition to electric vehicles across that market. Indeed, it's a structure and an opportunity that we think can be replicated across multiple parts of the region.
So it sounds like green investment is good investment and it's the way of the future. Would you agree with that?
Well, I've committed a career to that thesis. But what I would, you know, so maybe maybe you might say I've drunk the Kool-Aid, to use an expression. But what I'll do is try and sort of dispassionately stand back. And what we know is the demand for energy continues to grow. We know that through the benefit of low cost, of capturing a more secure energy supply, and through increasing focus on the climate agenda, that the rate of deployment for renewable energy will only continue to accelerate. We know that demand for that product, as businesses, as industry, and as communities more generally, you know, adopt their own transition plans, will only continue to go and will probably grow, and indeed all of the figures suggest will grow at a faster rate than we're able to supply that capacity. To me, that underpins the attractiveness of this as an investment opportunity while also delivering on a much broader sort of benefit of delivering a just and equitable energy transition. From our observations are that increasingly investors are putting climate at the centre of their investment decisions. We look at global capital allocators increasing their commitment and focus and in some cases actually placing prohibitions on themselves for investing outside of that agenda, sort of directly or indirectly. And we're certainly seeing, and I talked about this earlier, sort of corporates, industrial companies, you know, setting their own sort of net zero plans and that only further drives sort of both activity and therefore capital allocation and investment into that space. I think we see that firsthand. We see it in all of the numbers that underpin sort of the forecasts. And certainly from my perspective, I don't see that trend shifting anytime soon.
Great. Ed, it's been great talking to you today. Thank you so much. You've given me a lot of hope that future direction of investment, particularly green investment in Asia, is only going to go one way, and that's forward. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Send your feedback to podcast@sbh.com.sg. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or within our Straits Times app. Thanks for listening.